There is now an exam 4 page on the website. Now, I want to start by talking again about clonal selection. That's what we talked about last time, except we emphasized what happens with B cells. Now, there is a diagram of this on the handout from last time, if you have it. If you don't, I notice I have a lot of handouts left over from last time. There's a pile over here. You don't really need it, but if you have it handy or you want to look at it, it's 24C. Now, what we have there is a picture of how clonal selection works. And if you may remember, the basic idea is that if you have a precursor to B cells, this divides, and each of the corresponding cells produces a different antibody, but it's a surface antibody. Now, we explained that in order to do this, the DNA rearranges. The immune system is the exception. In all the other cells of your body, the DNA is exactly the same as each other and the same as the DNA in the original zygote that you inherited. But in the B and the T cells, it's different. So this DNA rearrangement occurs, and we'll talk about the details of it later, in the precursors to both B and T cells. Now notice this happens before antigen. And that's true in both B and T cells. The DNA arranges before antigen. Now, what's different about T cells is what this protein is. T cells also make a surface protein capable of binding antigen. So we'll call it a specific protein, because the protein always has one end with a specific binding site for antigen. In the case of B cells, that's antibody. In the case of T cells, it's TCR, or the T cell receptor. So with T cells, it would look the same, except these would be T cell receptors instead of antibodies. Now, since this is on the surface, when antibody is on the surface, antibody on surface is sometimes called BCR, or B cell receptor, because this antibody or T cell receptor now serves as a trap for antigen. So when the appropriate antigen comes along, say this one, this antigen will bind to the cell, to the surface protein that matches it. And the cell which has that surface protein, in that case this one, this cell will now multiply and make many descendants. And this is called clonal expansion. And the cells that it makes, some of them will be memory cells to wait for next time. Some of them will be effector cells that will secrete antibody. Now, we explained last time that there is memory and there is tolerance. This explains memory. You make many, many cells, all capable of making the same antibody or the same T cell receptor. And some of these are effector cells. They do their thing. They make secreted antibody. They kill other cells. We'll explain what effector cells do again more. And some of these are memory cells that just wait around for next time. Now, this is how you explain memory, because there are more cells waiting around next time, therefore the response is faster, bigger, etc. But sometimes you get tolerance. Under certain conditions, when the antibody or the T cell receptor meets its partner, instead of getting clonal expansion, instead this cell is either destroyed or suppressed. It doesn't divide, it doesn't make progeny. And then you get tolerance. instead of memory. If this cell is out of commission, then you can't make antibody to this antigen or this protein, and this protein will not be recognized as foreign. And so it will be tolerated. So the big distinction really is whether this protein counts as a foreign material antigen and triggers clonal expansion, memory, etc., or whether this partner is perceived as self, in which case the combination is destroyed and you get tolerance. Now this is the same again for B cells and T cells. Now so far, everything we've sort of said sounds like it's the same. That you get either clonal expansion or suppression when the surface protein meets antigen. That's the same for both of them. And in both cases, if you get expansion, you get a mixture of memory cells and effector cells. Now, it's clear that what the effector cells do is different in these two cases. We'll come back to that. But what is the difference in this clonal selection scheme? What's the big difference between B cells and T cells? Well, notice they make different certain surface proteins. One makes antibody, but it's attached to the surface, and one makes T cell receptor. But now, further down the line, after clonal selection, these cells will secrete the antibody, which is now on the surface. When these cells get activated, they will make a secreted version of this antibody. But when T cells get activated, they never secrete T cell receptors. So if you consider the specific protein on the surface, is it ever secreted? And the answer with antibody is yes, and the answer with T cell receptors is no. T cell receptors are always found on the surface of the cell that makes them. They are never found loose in the serum. Now there's one other big difference here, which I guess has to do with the effector cell part. Or let's look at it this way. We have this specific protein. It meets a partner, which let's assume it's foreign, it's an antigen. What state does the antigen have to be? Can the antigen be just free, loose? Or does the antigen have to be on the surface of another cell? In the case of B cells, the antigen can be floating loose and it will bind to the antibody and you make a complex. But in the case of a T cell receptor, so let's say this is a T cell and this is its T cell receptor, if plain old antigen comes along loose, these two will not combine. For a T cell receptor, the antigen as well as the binding protein both have to be on cell surfaces. So can you bind free antigen? And the answer is yes, no. Now this is diagrammed on today's handout on the top of A. So here we have a B cell with its antibody. And here we have a T cell with its TCR. And in this particular picture, they have the same antigenic specificity. They bind to the same antigen. Except, of course, this is an antibody. And this is a TCR. But now, suppose free antigen comes along, a free piece of protein. Remember, the antibody or the TCR binds to a little piece of protein, a little piece of antigen, which is called an epitope or antigenic determinant. This little free piece can bind to the antibody, but it can't bind to the TCR. Now, is this the only place antibody is found? When this cell is activated, what will happen? It will start secreting antibody. So there's also free antibody, and of course free antibody can combine with loose antigen too. But both free antibody and antibody on the surface, aka the BCR, the B cell receptor, both of these forms of antibody can combine with loose antigen. Not so for a T cell receptor. the antigen has to be on the surface of a eukaryotic cell. And if it's not on the surface of a eukaryotic cell, the T cell receptor will not stick to it. Now, this raises the question, how does the T cell know, quote unquote, this is a eukaryotic cell, not a bacterium, not something else? And we will return to that question of what identifies a eukaryotic cell as a eukaryotic cell. Well, maybe I should tell you right away, it's the protein called MHC to which we will return. That turns out to be the secret. But we don't want to get into the fine points yet. Okay. Now, we're talking here about B cells versus T cells. But we explained last time that there are really two kinds of T cells. Cytotoxic T cells and helper T cells. So T cells divide into cytotoxic T or cytotoxic lymphocytes and helper T cells. And of course, these subdivide too, but we're not going into that. Now, what I want to consider now is, what is the difference in what they do? If a T cell binds to its target, what happens next? Now, you have to consider what it binds to because it's a little different. The T cell, a cytotoxic T cell, binds to what we've called rogue cells, cells that are making funny proteins. The most famous case are infected cells. It's possible that also some cancer cells and some other cells fall into this category. So cytotoxic T cells bind only to regular cells of the body that are doing something weird. This is the only combination. But what about T helper cells? They bind to cells of the immune system. Primarily, and one of the kind of cells they bind to are B cells. They bind to other cells too, but not to other T cells, but they bind to other cells of the immune system, and we'll come back to that. Now, they're called helpers. Notice that these two have different targets. The two kinds of T cells have different targets, and then what happens when they hit their target? A cytotoxic T is cytotoxic. It kills the cell. So the net result of this combination is to kill the infected cell. Signaling from the cytotoxic T cell induces apoptosis in the infected cell. So the infected cell dies, taking with it whatever peculiarities it had. But a helper T cell helps. So when a helper T cell binds to a B cell, it in fact activates or turns on the B cell. It turns out that B cell binding to antigen isn't sufficient. To get clonal expansion of B cells, not only must the B cell bind antigen, but it also has to meet a helper T cell. So when the B cell binds antigen and meets a helper T cell, that leads to activation of the B cell, meaning that the B cell will divide and multiply and make effector cells and memory cells and secrete antibody and generate an immune response. How did the T cells get activated? We're saying here if a helper T is activated, it can turn on a B cell. If a cytotoxic T is turned on, it can kill an infected cell. But how do you turn on the T cells in the first place? Now, the short answer is that for a cytotoxic T to get activated, it has to meet an infected cell, and it has to have some stuff from a T helper. Here, for a T helper to be activated, one way is to meet a B cell. This activation is actually mutual. B kicks in T helper kicks in B. But T helpers can also be activated by meeting a phagocytic cell of the immune system. The one we talked about the most are macrophages, but there are others which may be even more important. An example is a macrophage. The phagocytic cell can turn on the helper cell. Nothing happens in this case to the phagocytic cell. So this activation is in one direction. If the T cell is already activated, so is this one. But if neither one is activated, they can activate each other. And this is this one. And what we want to look at now is, how does a phagocyte or a B cell turn on a T helper cell? How does a T helper cell turn on a B cell? And how does an infected cell turn on a T cytotoxic C cell? Now you can see these are sort of important. If you turn on your immune system when you don't need it, you're in big trouble. Then you destroy your own proteins, or you get allergies or worse. I should say allergies or worse, because the allergy isn't so bad, but destroying your own proteins is much worse. So this process is fairly tightly controlled. How does it work? Now, the first thing to realize is any of these activations, any of these arrows that I drew, require two things, two different signals, at least. At least one paracrine signal and one juxtacrine. And they may well require more of each. Now, what does paracrine mean? It means that some cell secretes something which acts locally. In this particular case, for example, the B cell makes something which activates the helper, and the helper makes something that activates the B. In this case, the paracrine comes from a helper. Now, we've talked about paracrines a lot already and how paracrine signaling works, so I don't want to belabor it. I want to concentrate on juxtacrine because we didn't talk about that very much. But before I do it, I just want to say a word or two about the terminology. The paracrine molecules, the paracrine signaling molecules, are generally called cytokines. These are proteins that stimulate the immune system, or I should say regulate the immune system, because some of them are stimulatory and some of them are inhibitory. Now, for historical reasons, many of these are known as interleukins. And so they're called IL-1, IL-2, IL-3, etc. I think we're up to about 20. And the IL stands for interleukin, because they were thought to be between leukocytes or white blood cells. But right now, the general term for all of them is cytokines. Now, exactly what happens in certain combinations when certain cells meet each other depends on what interleukin is secreted at that junction. And we're not going to go into it. If you're interested, you can look in more extensive texts. All I want to explain is the terminology, so if you read further, you'll understand. I want to concentrate on the juxtacrine signaling. We haven't talked about that very much. What is juxtacrine signaling? What did you say? Say it again.
The two cells are in contact.
So that means that the receptor is on the surface of one cell and the ligand is on the surface of the other. And in fact, sometimes it's arbitrary which is the receptor and which is the ligand. It means that you have proteins on the surface of one cell which interdigitate with proteins on the surface of the other cell, and this signals one or both cells to do something. Juxtacrine signaling is very big in the immune system. Now, before we get into the fine points of what happens when you make one of these juxtacrine hookups, what happens? We have said that you can activate here a cytotoxic T by the right combination of paracrine and juxtacrine, a helper T cell, or a B cell. What do they do once they're activated? Now, we've actually sort of said what happens when you activate B cells. You make effector cells and memory cells. Actually, that's true for all three of them. You make effector cells and memory cells. But what do the effectors do? If you have an effector cytotoxic T cell, what does it do? Well, its name gives it away. It's a cytotoxic T cell. It kills its target. It induces apoptosis. If you have a B cell effector cell, what does it do? When this cell becomes an effect, when it multiplies and its descendants become an effector, what's the big thing they do? They secrete antibody. So what was before on the surface, now they make lots of and secrete it. So what activated B cells, effector B cells do, is they secrete antibody. Now what do activated helper T cells, effector helper T cells do? Well, they help. That's where their name comes from. They help other cells of the immune system do their thing. The T helper cells provide either paracrine, juxtacrine, or both signals to macrophages, B cells, etc., and help them do what they're supposed to do. So they literally, they help other cells of the immune system, which includes cytotoxic Ts. And to put it more succinctly, perhaps, the helper T is required for one or both signals to activate either a B or a cytotoxic T. And that's why having no helper T cells is so bad, because you can't activate either your cell-mediated immunity or your humoral immunity. Okay. So having said all of that, how do you actually pull off one of these activations? Clearly, activation involves the T or the B cell meeting its antigen, and somehow a helper T cell comes into it somehow. But the part that perhaps needs the most explaining is we've said there are two kinds of T cells, cytotoxic and helper. Now, this says that cytotoxic T cells only bind to bad cells and kill them. Cytotoxic T cells don't get mixed up and bind to B cells and kill them. Similarly, helper cells bind to B cells and help them out. They don't bind to T cells, cytotoxic Ts. So how do the T cells tell the two kinds of targets apart? In other words, how do the right kind of T cell pair up with the right partner and give the right signals and do the right thing? And the key to that, again, is this protein called MHC. So that's what I want to talk about next. Now, in the notes, there are a lot of details about MHC, and if we have time, I'll come back to them at the end. But all I want to say right now is that MHCs are a group of proteins that are very variable, not because of DNA rearrangements, but because there are multiple genes that you inherit, and each of those genes has multiple alleles. So as a result, you are able to make a fairly large collection of MHCs. And there are two main categories of MHC called MHC1 and MHC2. And this is the big distinction, although there are subtypes of one and subtypes of two. Now, where are these found? MHC1 is found on all nucleated cells. So who doesn't have it? Red blood cells don't have it because they don't have nuclei. And MHC2 is found on certain cells of the immune system. It's found on B cells and phagocytic cells. It is not found most of the time on T cells. So now if we consider the pair up between T cells and their targets, you want to go back to the handout again. And you want to look at the second pair on the top of 25A. Because what we've drawn here now is the difference between a cytotoxic T cell and a helper T cell. Now, we already know that a T cell has T cell receptor on it. But you also remember there are other surface proteins, and the two we talked about last time were CD4 and CD8. Helper cells have CD4. Except I drew it this way. And cytotoxic T cells have CD8. I guess you can't see that so good. Okay. Now, the CD actually matches up with a part of the MHC. The T cell receptor part matches up with the epitope or antigen, and the CD4 or 8 part matches up with the MHC. Well, what are cytotoxic cells, cytotoxic T cells, supposed to zap? They're supposed to zap an ordinary cell that has gone bad. If it's an ordinary cell, which kind of MHC does it have? It has one. So it has MHC1, and it has some antigen. Both of them are required to make a matchup. That in order for have proper juxtacrine signaling, both of these have to pair up and match. So the T cell receptor part matches the antigen, and the CD8 part matches the MHC. And the result of that signaling plus the proper paracrines will be destruction of the target cell. But now, what about a B cell or a phagocytic cell of the immune system that needs help? It has antigen, but what kind of MHC does it have? It actually has both. And we've left off MHC1 because it doesn't matter here. The critical thing is that it has MHC2. So because it has MHC2 and antigen, it can pair up with a T helper cell. And what's going to be the result here? If these two pair up, what is going to happen? How do you activate a T helper cell? From meeting one of these so-called antigen-presenting cells, or APCs. A cell that has antigen on its surface in a combination with MHC2 is called an antigen-presenting cell. Phagocytic cells of the immune system have it, B cells have it, T cells don't. And so this cell is, as they say, displaying its antigen on the surface, and that is what allows it to bind to a T cell. Now, you could say this cell up here is also displaying its antigen on the surface, but this is usually referred to as an infected cell and not an antigen-presenting cell. Sometimes people call both of these antigen-presenting cells because they've all got their antigen on the surface, but it's only if you got it with antigen with MHC2 that you're called a classic antigen-presenting cell. In the infected cell, you have your antigen with MHC1, and that's considered to be different, and that allows you to get zapped by a cytotoxic T. How does the antigen get on the surface? We don't normally think of it that way. We think of proteins are inside the cell, right? Maybe there's some cell surface proteins. But how do the antigens get on the surface? It turns out that these antigens get on the surface in a different way than these antigens get on the surface. And that's critical to why one of them ends up attached to MHC and one to MHC2. If you look at your handout, you will notice on the right-hand side, this is a slightly different picture of MHC and antigen. In this picture here, we drew the MHC and the antigen separately to try and make the point of how things pair up. But the truth is, they're together. The MHC is a holder for antigen. It holds a small piece of protein, a short peptide. And so that's why the picture looks more like this, or like this. There's a groove in the middle of the MHC, and a piece of antigen, an epitope, fits there. People refer to this as the hot dog in a bun model. Because the MHC is like a bun. It has a groove and the little bit of antigen, the little bit of peptide, like a hot dog in the bun. Now, a large variety of different peptides can fit in the same MHC. Not every MHC can hold every peptide, but a given MHC can hold a variety of peptides in the groove. Just as you can put several different kinds of things in a bun and get different kinds of sandwiches, but there's a limit to what you can put in there, but there's variety. So what really happens is the CDC, CD8 or the CD4 binds to this part, the MHC, and the TCR binds to the antigen part. But they're together. What happens is, in the case of an infected cell, actually any cell at all, any cell at all is making proteins. Proteins are floating around inside in the cytoplasm. And some of them are degraded in proteasomes. Probably old proteins get sent to the recycling center. And so you have little pieces of protein made by the proteasomes. And a sample of those pieces gets stuck onto MHC and stuck onto the surface. So in an ordinary cell, you have proteins made inside the cell. And courtesy of the proteasome, you get fragments. And they actually enter the ER using a special transporter. And in the ER, they meet MHC1. So MHC1 picks up the fragments. And then it ends up going through the endomembrane system and being stuck on the surface of the cell. So the surface of every cell contains MHC1 carrying little bits of whatever it's making. So the T cells from the outside know what that cell is making. And if that cell is making foreign protein, goodbye. But what about these cells? How do they get foreign protein? They get foreign protein from the outside. As opposed to your ordinary cell, which displays what it's made inside, B cells and phagocytic cells display what they captured, what came from the outside. How does a phagocytic cell get material from the outside? A phagocytic cell is like an amoeba. It does phagocytosis. It engulfs things. It brings them in to endosomes and lysosomes and chews them up. And then those pieces meet MHC2, probably in endosomes. So it takes stuff from the outside by phagocytosis. It goes into endosomes, gets degraded to little bits, medium size, and meets MHC2. And then that, again, is part of the endomembrane system. Through vesicles, it goes to the plasma membrane, fuses, and displayed on the outside. How does a B cell get anything? B cells don't phagocytose. B cells look like this. What do you think happens when these two get it together? Receptor-mediated endocytosis. You take in from the outside whatever stuck to your antibody, and that is chewed up into pieces and stuck onto MHC2. So from a phagocyte, stuff from the outside is phagocytosed. From a B cell, stuff comes in by receptor-mediated endocytosis. Now, what's the difference? Both of them take stuff from the outside. A phagocyte can take in anything it can gulp. Anything it can eat or engulf indiscriminately ends up on its MHC2. What is a B cell going to put on its MHC2? What can a B cell capture? Only what sticks to its antibody. So it's very picky about what it sticks on its MHC2. It's pieces of antigen it's going to put on its MHC2. But both of these cells now display pieces of whatever they took in on their outside. And that's why they're called antigen-presenting cells. And these combination allows them to bind to a T helper cell. And the combination activates the T helper cell. And as we said, it also activates the B cell if it isn't activated yet. Yeah.
Once the antigen binds to the helper cell, is it ever destroyed?
Okay, now, if you look at this combination, suppose this is a B cell and this is a T helper cell. The question is, what happens to antigen? When these two get it together, if the T helper cell is already activated, it activates the B cell. If neither is activated, they activate each other. If this is a phagocytic cell, it can't be activated, but it activates the T helper cell. But once the signals have gone back and forth, where is the antigen really attached? The antigen is attached firmly to MHC2. So when these two cells pull apart, the antigen goes with the MHC2 cell. And now this cell can go and activate another T helper. And the T helper can go and activate another immune system cell. But what happens is the helper cell or the cytotoxic T cell owns the T cell receptor and the CD4R8. But the target cell, so to speak, owns the MHC and the antigen piece inside it. And if they separate, the antigen stays with this cell.
So what was the purpose of them getting together?
So what's the purpose of getting them together at all? Until they get together, the T helper cell cannot multiply and divide, and the B cell cannot multiply and divide. Now, how do you think it works? What people think happens is when antigen first comes along, it probably ends up inside a phagocyte, which goes around gobbling everything. And that activates a T helper cell. The T helper cell multiplies, and then it goes around activating B cells. And so eventually, you activate first the T helper cell and then the B cell. Yeah?
Does this all happen in the same place in the body,
Where does this happen? There are special locations in the body, such as in the spleen and the lymph nodes, where most of this happens. How does what get there? Well, the cells circulate through the body, and so does antigen in the blood. And so it hangs up in the various specialized places where you have a much higher concentration of cells and antigen. Yeah?
What's the point of taking the antibody in if it's just going to spit it out again?
What's the point of taking the antigen in if it's going to just spit it out again? If you start out with a cell that looks like this, and this antigen, well, what is this really? This is usually something big, like a protein. But it has, so there's a whole big protein here. But it's this little epitope or piece of the protein that binds to the antibody. So now, by this little handle, the B cell takes in the whole thing. Now, what's going to end up being put back with MHC2?
Oh,
a little bit of this, and a little bit of this, and a little bit of this, and a little bit of this. So what ends up being displayed with MHC2 is going to be all kinds of little different pieces. And therefore, this is capable of matching up with a very wide variety of T helper cells. So the point of taking it in and displaying it is that it allows you to display all of the pieces of the whole protein. Any more questions before we go on? Yeah.
I want to talk about tolerance.
Yeah.
So this could happen to, B cells can accidentally capture something that's self. So they do that all the time.
Her question is, if B cells capture self, what happens? The B cell that captures self is destroyed very early on. Now, we have talked about needing a paracrine signal and a juxtacrine signal for clonal expansion. You probably need another signal as well. If you get the whole caboodle of signals, you get clonal expansion. If you get one less signal, you get clonal suppression or destruction. So at the appropriate time, under the appropriate conditions, if this is self, you don't get the additional signal, and so this combination leads to destruction instead of leading to expansion. The idea is that early in development, and as they arise, you destroy both B cells and T cells capable of reacting with yourself. Under normal conditions, those cells are either destroyed or suppressed. And one of the problems with immune system autoimmune diseases is that this suppression is broken. And cells that ought to be destroyed or suppressed are now making antibody to parts of you they're supposed to ignore. Yeah?
Is there any harm to the beta cell linking, being around and having it? Okay, I know let's say it's a foreign antigen that doesn't belong. The beta cell takes it and chops it up and displays it. In those chopped up pieces, they just stay there forever.
What her question has to do with the length of time that cells last. Effector cells don't last very long. They do their thing and then die by apoptosis after a fairly short time. Memory cells don't do much of anything, but they last for a long time, years, decades, sometimes a lifetime. So this cell can be floating around, but it won't be floating around that long because it will be destroyed. Now, I want to look at this from another angle. We've been talking now about cells. B cells, T cytotoxics, T helpers, and sort of all their ramifications and combinations. And we did have to talk about proteins a little, but I want to now focus on the protein. In particular, I want to focus on the antibody. I want to look at the structure of this features and structure of this protein and figure out how it does it, what it's supposed to do. Now, for this, you need B. Which summarizes many of the critical points. There are actually five classes of antibody. And their properties are listed for reference in this little table at the top. And they're called Ig for immunoglobulin, IgM, IgD, IgG, IgE, and IgA. All of these are antibodies, and they can exist either in a membrane-bound form or in a secreted form. IgD is only found traces in the serum, and probably its function is not known. And whether it's the serum part, whether the antibody in the serum has any function is not known. Now, every antibody has the same basic setup. If you look at on the right, in the middle of the page, every antibody, whatever class, looks sort of like this. It has two grabber ends, or ends that are specific for antigen, that bind only one or a very small number of related epitopes. So this is the part that is specific for antigen, antigen binding. And this is different in every antibody. And it has a different amino acid sequence coded for by a different DNA sequence. And so it folds up in a different shape and binds a different antigen. And each cell in a clone, each of these cells makes a different variable region with a different binding specificity. Now, these two binding sites are the same. If you were to cut the antibody this way, the top and the bottom halves would be identical. But then there's this part back here. The part that binds antigen is called the variable part because it varies from one antibody to another. This part is called the constant part All the antibodies of the same class have the same constant part. So all IgGs have the same constant part, all IgAs, etc. Now, there are some subclasses, but we're ignoring. And let me just say that all the antibodies made by a cell, by one cell and its descendants, have essentially the same variable. So once the DNA rearrangement has occurred, all the descendants from here have essentially almost exactly the same DNA and almost exactly the same variable. Now, if this binds antibody, what do you need the constant part for? The constant part determines where the antibody will be found and what will happen when it binds antigen. In other words, it determines its biological effects. IgMs have different biological effects from IgAs. And some of these are listed for references in your table. For example, IgA is found mainly in secretions. IgA is found in tears, sweat, etc. While IgM is found first, usually, IgG, E, and A later. Now, you notice that M and G fix complement, but not the others. That means that the M and the G type can activate complement, and complement, remember, helps make holes in bacteria. IgA generally doesn't do that. So this determines the biological effect. Well, the constant, while the variable determines what antigen the antibody will stick to. Now, there are five main types of constant region, as you can see, because there are five classes. When this cell multiplies and has many descendants, all forming a clone, all of these cells make identical or very similar V regions. But the kicker is they can have different constant regions. So the variable part stays the same, and the constant part changes. The descendants have the same grabber, but they can have a different back end. This is called class switching. A cell can start out with an antibody like this, which say this is one class, and later on it makes a similar antibody, same variable end, but different constant. And one of the questions we want to ask is, how is this possible? In fact, there are really two questions that arise from everything that I've said so far. One of them is the specificity variable end. How can you make so many different antibodies with so many different binding sites? You can make zillions. No, people have made calculations, but you can make hundreds of millions of different antibodies. How is that possible? So how can you get so much variety in the variable end? And the second question is, once you made an antibody, how can you switch the back end without switching the front end? How can you do class switching? Well, I think what we want to look at a little bit more closely is we have to look at the actual peptide change in this thing in order to explain it. So now if you look to the left here, we've drawn an antibody in terms of peptide chains. Every antibody is made of these tetramers or combinations thereof. Two bigger chains and two smaller chains. The big chains are called H chains for heavy chains because they have a larger molecular weight. And the smaller chains are called light chains because they have a lower molecular weight. Now remember we said if you split it in half, it's the same, top and bottom. So the two light chains in every antibody are the same, and the two heavy chains are the same. And the dotted line here separates the variable part from the constant part. So each chain has a variable part. And each chain, heavy or light, has a constant part. All these together make up the constant. Now, this part here is often called the hinge region. It's a little bit flexible. So really, the antibody looks more like this. And these together, the end of the light chain and the end of the heavy chain together, make the grabber or the combining site. So this is one, and this is the other. And here's the constant part. And the constant part of the heavy chain is what determines class. So there are five possibilities here. That's why you have the stuff on the top. For IgM, you have what is called a mu heavy chain. For IgA, you have what is called an alpha heavy chain. So it's the heavy chain part. The constant part of the heavy chain determines whether you're talking about an alpha, beta, I mean an A, a G, an M, etc. So what we're saying is that you can start out making an antibody like this, and then you can change this part. Now, to give you some idea of what we're talking about, we should look at back at A on the bottom. What this shows is the class of antibody made by a B cell as it goes from here at the top all the way down to the bottom. So you start with a precursor to a B cell. This is an ordinary cell in the sense that its DNA is exactly the same as that of the zygote and every other cell. And this goes through a bunch of steps before it makes antigen. So this is pre-antigen. Remember, before you meet antigen, the cells each rearrange their DNA to make their own private antibody. And when it does that, the antibody that it makes is membrane-bound and class M. That's the first thing. It takes multiple steps. Then, the same cell makes D class antibody, same grabbers, but a D back end. And it has both M and D. And at this stage, the cell is mature enough to respond to antigen. Back here, if you add antigen, nothing happens. The cell isn't ready. But this cell is ready to respond to antigen. Now notice it's making antibody already. And the grabber part, the specificity part, is predetermined by however it rearranged its DNA and whatever it happens to be making. But now what happens if antigen comes along? This is called a naive B cell because it has never met antigen. In the old literature, it is called a virgin B. Same thing, but you can see why we changed it. So this is a naive B cell, and if it meets antigen, they're going to get clonal expansion, and you're going to get memory cells and effector cells. And what the effector cells are going to do is they are going to now secrete M. They don't apparently secrete D. They just secrete M. Those are your effector cells. Now notice we've switched. We haven't switched classes, but we've switched from making membrane-bound antibody to secreted antibody. Do we know how to do that? Remember, that's alternate splicing and or addition of poly A. You add poly A in a different place so that you get a protein with a hydrophilic tail instead of a hydrophobic tail. So the protein is secreted instead of locked in the membrane. We know how that happens. But in addition, you now form memory cells which have surface antibody, but it's not M or D anymore. Instead, it's A, G, or E. Some, depending on the fine points, it can be any one of these or a mixture. All of these have the same specific grabber end of their antibody, but their constant end is different. And the reason I wrote it this way is it turns out that you make G first, and then it can turn. You can make G can make change to make A, and G can change to make E, and E can make change to make A, but not the other combinations, as we will explain. Now, what happens if antibody comes along a second time? If you have this type of memory cell, when antibody comes along the second time, this will make secreted E and some more memory cells. If you have this kind, you'll make secreted G and some more memory cells, and so on. So this is post-antigen. So what the cell has done is to make the same specific grabber front end, first with M, then also with D, then with either G, A, or E, and it's also switched from membrane-bound to secreted. How does it do it? We know how you can switch from making the membrane-bound version to the secreted version. But we don't know how you do the others. It turns out that this difference here is due to alternate splicing and poly-A addition, just like this one. But these other changes at this step and at all of these others, one rearranges the DNA. The immune system is in many ways the exception to all of the rules. All of the other cells have the same DNA. But the DNA of B cells and T cells is rearranged to allow each B cell clone to make a unique antibody and each T cell clone to make a unique T cell receptor. It goes further than that. If you have genetic information to make H chains, how many copies of it do you have? You have genetic information to make anything. How many copies of it do you have? You have, I hope, two parents. So you have two copies of the genetic information, one from your mom, one from your dad. So you have information to make two different H chains. But in fact, each cell makes only one. This is, we always say that if you have two alleles in a cell, you read out both of them. This is the exception. In this case, you read out one allele for the H chain and one allele for the L chain, and the cell makes only one type of antibody or one type of TCR. It can be a different copy in different cells. It doesn't have to be the same.
Okay. That reminds me of like the sex cells, only one works at a time. Is it
like the sex cells where you have a female with two X's and only one of the two works? This is another example of it. But it's a little different here because what happens is that one allele rearranges and not the other. And only the rearranged allele with the DNA rearranged is the one that's read out and used.
Is that done during development?
And that happens during development, yes. Okay. So we've been talking about all of this by looking at the protein. To figure out what's happening, how you do class switching, and how you make so many of these, you have to go one step further and look at the DNA. So now you want to go back to B on the bottom, where we've drawn out the DNA that you inherit. And we've just written one allele here of each. Now, I just talked about the gene for the H chain. The amazing fact is that you don't have a gene for the H chain. You have a stretch of DNA with sections that code for pieces of the H chain. People say the genes for the antibodies and the TCRs are mosaic. This is the DNA that codes for the H chain. It has a whole bunch of sequences that are called V, a whole bunch that are called D, you see 4 to 6, and a bunch that are called J. In order to actually make an antibody, the DNA is have to recombine. So you stick one V next to one D next to one J. And that together is going to code for the variable region, the antigen binding part of your antibody. This is going to be the V, except this time I'll call it V like this, meaning the whole variable part. So the DNA has little segments, not a complete gene, and you're going to rearrange these. And then down here, you have the sections that code for the various alternative constant regions. You have the section that codes for mu, the section that codes for delta, etc., up to alpha. So you can use this VDJ combination and this piece of the DNA and make an M antibody. You can use this VDJ combination, say, and this part of the DNA, and you get an A antibody. Now, we haven't explained how you do it, but that's the basic idea. Now, you notice that you have this structure coding for an H chain. So how many different H chains do you think you can make? Many, because there are several hundred combinations here, times 4 to 6 here, times 10 to 20 here. Now, it gets even more complicated. Not only can you do a mix-a-match-em, in addition of the segments, BDJ, when you make the joints by recombining the DNA using enzymes that are unique to these cells, when you make the VDJ combination, the joints aren't exact. So you can have plus or minus a few bases in here, plus or minus a few bases in here. So the joints are inexact. And that greatly multiplies the number of combos possible. But this is just the H chain. What about the L chain? You look down, you see that there are two different genes for the L chain called kappa and lambda. And each of them has segments. They have V's and J's, no D. But for the L chain also, you do a mix and a match. Yeah?
If you're altering a few bases, why doesn't that cause a frame shift?
Why doesn't it cause a frame shift? Because a reasonable number of times you insert or add a multiple of 3. Now, this rearrangement deal doesn't always produce a DNA that codes for a working protein. And if it doesn't, then the other H-chain allele recombines. And if that doesn't work, the cell dies. So it doesn't work every time. So you do this mix and match and inexact joints for X, for H. You do mix and match and inexact joints for L, and then you put H and L together in any combination, any H with any L. And that is how you get this enormous variety of antibodies with an enormous variety here. Now, you have superimposed on this a phenomenon which happens, all of this happens before or after antigen. All of that happens here to get to this stage. We have to do all of that to get here. There is a little more change in the DNA afterwards, which is called somatic mutation, and we're not going to go into it, and we're going to largely ignore it. But just for the record, you should know that it exists, and it's explained in the nuts. So we've explained how you can get a huge variety of these guys. But now, how do you get cells that can make M, cells that can make M and D, cells that can make instead G, E, or A? And for that, you want to look at the last page of the handout, which diagrams it out. Now, you don't have to know all these details. This is just so you get some idea what we're talking about. If you have an original DNA, and now we're just talking about the part that codes for the H chain. Remember, you have multiple Vs, you have multiple D segments, multiple Js, and a series of constants. So in this stage here, you recombine the DNA using special enzymes, so you end up with one V next to one D next to one J. So this should be a J. Okay. So now the DNA has one V, one D, one J, and still has all the constants. Now, at this point, what you do is you either transcribe this much. This is what happens next. You transcribe that much. There's some introns you have to get rid of. And you add poly A at the end here. And what is this going to code for? It has the VDJ and the mu part of constant. So this is going to make an M chain with a particular VDJ. And this is gives you this step. Now, how does it make D2? After it's made M, it apparently makes D. The DNA doesn't change. So how can you get D out of this DNA? Who do you have to skip? You have to skip this. So actually, by splicing of the RNA, not by changing the DNA, you splice the RNA differently, and you take out this part. And so instead of adding poly A here, you add poly A at the very end. And that allows you to make the D version. So alternate splicing poly A addition to the primary transcript gives you M or D. And these are both membrane bound. But when you meet antigen, You make soluble M. How do you do that? You must have added the poly A here. If you add poly A here, you're missing the hydrophobic tail, and you make soluble M. So all of these variations here are due to alternate splicing. But how are you going to make the G version? You make the G version by playing around with the DNA some more. And that's shown where it says memory cells, secondary response. These, to make memory cells generally have G, E, or A on their surface. So you have to do that a little differently. Here's your same old DNA, same as this one. It's got VDJ, still got mu, delta, gamma. Okay, how can we get rid of, what do we do now? We rearrange the DNA one more time, and we take that out. This is not at the RNA level, but the DNA level. Immune cells only, B and T. So we take out this DNA, and now you have VDJ, gamma, blah, 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 blah. So you transcribe this and add poly A, and you make the G version. Notice it's making the same grabber part, same variable part, but a different constant. Yeah?
Well, why does it have to rearrange the DNA? Why can't it do alternate?
Could you do it by alternate splicing? Maybe, but cells don't. And the other reason for not doing it by alternate splicing, as far as I know, this distance is quite large. But the real answer is this is the way it is. One could have set it up so it was all DNA rearrangements, all RNA rearrangements, but this is just the way it is. Now, I want to wrap this up by talking about one more thing. Before I forget, there's still this unclaimed book here, and these are regrades for I have all of them from exam 3 and some of them from exam 2, and it says on the front which I have and which I don't here. I want to just say one more thing about this whole business. We talked about three different proteins here which have variable ends and constant ends. What are they? Well, this is obviously the first one. Antibody has a variable end and a constant end. The TCR does too. It has a variable end and a constant end. And the third one is MHC. So antibody, TCR, and MHC all have a variable end and a constant end. The variation in the variable end of antibody and TCR is due to DNA rearrangements. The variation in MHC variable end is due to the variants you inherit. These two are much more specific and pickier. Their variable end will bind only to one or a very small number of things. But the MHC hot dog bun will bind to a variable number, quite a large number of different antigens, allowing you to display a whole bunch of different ones. These are not just accidentally the same. They have a common evolutionary origin. And this is clear if you see them lined up against each other, and there are links in the notes if you're interested. It shows them, pictures from Albert's, that shows them lined up. All of them have the same domain, which is called an immunoglobulin domain, repeated many times. You may remember that many different proteins have the same or similar sequence found in them. And this sequence is thought to be of common evolutionary origin from all of them. And it's a very common thing to find the same protein, same domain, being used in different proteins. And this is another example of it. Now, the immune system, as you may understand, is an extremely complicated business. We would all be in very sad shape without it, but its working is very complicated, and there are whole courses in that, just as there are whole courses in physiology, so whole courses in cell biology. And you can take any neurobiology and biochemistry, and you can take any of them next year. Thank you.